So, first of all, I'd like to... Oh, he's just having a cigarette, so you have to wait a minute. Oh, sorry. Okay, I'd like to introduce... I'm looking around for it. So I'd like to introduce Steve Mills, who's going to be speaking about the Kingswood Colliers.
Is that me or Bush?
That's you, man.
I'm all right, Spatty. Can you hear me all right? Thanks for coming tonight. First things first, I'd like to thank Roger for putting this together. I know he's put a lot of work in, and this is really quality. It's nice to see something like this happening in Bristol for the church. Yeah. I'd also like to thank I'd also like to thank Doreen Limeburr and also Ian Bishop, two local historians I've used heavily in what I'm going to speak about tonight. I tried to contact Doreen, hoping that she'd be willing to sell some of her books here tonight, but unfortunately I'm unable to contact her. But if you do see any of her books, The Annals of Kingswood, if it comes in three volumes, pick them up, they're only a couple of quid. And basically that's what I'm going to be using tonight. Right, Kingswood Forest, where do I start? Kingswood Forest was as the name suggests, a large forest that was outside of Bristol. So also sometimes it was known as without Lawford's Gate. Lawford's Gate was one of the major gates into Bristol, which is round about the old market by Trinity Road Prison, the police station, which you probably all know about. Lawford's Gate was out there, and outside of that was what we know now as Stapleton, Whitehall, St George, Barton Hill, going all the way up to Hannam and Kingswood as we know now. And at the time, most of that, all of that actually, was all known as Kingswood Forest. The people who populated it were seen to not be sort of proper Bristolians, if you like. They were outsiders, and in some cases were actually viewed as the enemy. And as I speak, we'll see how animosity between Britain and Bristolians and the Kingswood Colliers grew over a period of time. As the name suggests, Kingswood Forest was in fact the king's land, supposedly. Now and again he'd come down with all his courtiers and hangers-on and do a bit of deer hunting. He'd go careering around the forest looking for deer, running over the odd peasant in the peasant's land, and then going off again. It wasn't one of the most popular forests, and over a period of time it fell into disrepair. Squatting had occurred on the forest, but squatting really took off after, during the Civil War, when obviously Charles Stuart had his head knocked off. And basically what happened was there was some major landowners who were on the outside of the forest, and they slowly but surely encroached in over a period of time and just took over the forest. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, with a forest, you know, you get lots of timber, which is very important for the shipbuilding, but also the coal, which was very important. But I'll get onto that a bit more in a minute. I'm going to talk about a bit of the benefit of squatting, if you like, and how you could actually squat a bit of land like that. Has anybody ever heard of the one-bay house before? Thank you, Roger. Has anybody heard my last lecture? I'm sure you've heard of it before. Basically, a one-bay house is a structure that could be thrown up, and a bit like a beaver house, I suppose, this day and age, in between dusk to dawn. You put the house up, four walls and a chimney, and there had to be smoke coming out of that chimney at the end of the given period. And then, if you built that, and you could even close off some land and you could squat it. It's not squatting like the old squatters' rights you probably remember in the 60s and the 70s. You'd still have to pay some rent to the landlord, but the landlord wouldn't kick you off. And also you had common lands with the grazing rights, and also a lot of other benefits that you could get from common lands, not just taking your cows or your pigs on there. Obviously you could get nuts and berries, wood for burning, furs for thatching your roof, this sort of stuff, all sorts of building material. Common land was extremely useful to the poor. But also another thing about this as well, as I said, these large landowners who had nicked a little bit of land off the child had his head knocked off, basically they worked in conjunction with these singular squatters, because they actually supported each other in a way. They both stole the land together. Well, I mean, that's the loose interpretation of stealing land from the crown, but there you go. But they obviously supported each other. But one of the main benefits of living in Kingswood was the coal. There was actually in the day for it. There was loads of it there. And some of the big landowners, as I said, they operated quite large coal pits themselves. Also, they were more than happy to lease out little parcels of land for smaller operations. Sometimes a family concern, literally it'd be a granddad, a dad and a couple of boys perhaps, they just dig a hole down into the ground, literally down into the ground, and go down there and dig out coal. Extremely dangerous, very poorly trained as well, because once they got the coal out of the ground, they had to get it up topside, load it up, bring it into town, and then sell it. As I said, it was extremely dangerous. How they got down there most of the time was just by a simple rope system, where you had quite a few people actually hanging on to a rope, with the rope linked around their legs, and they'd just be lowered down like that. So I must admit, I mean, health and safety law at this day and age isn't the best, but that sounds really scary. As I said, the wages were very low, the profits were very minimal. I mean, some of the big companies, obviously, they did make some quite significant money out of it, but some of the smaller concerns is they were literally living from hand to mouth in very dangerous conditions. I'm going to talk a little bit about a disaster now in 1735, just to give you a feeling of how dangerous it could be. There was, 1735, there was a group of miners working under in a medial concern, and they must have hit the wrong wall a bit too hard, and water gushed through, and from a little hole with a little bit of water to a torrent that basically washed one person away who was never ever found again. Four people managed to find their way up to topside, but four people were stuck down. One was a young man called Abraham Fry, he was only 10 years old. And another one was a gentleman, John Smith, who was 70 years old, with two people in between. The bloke who was 70 years old was already a bit of a hero anyway, because as you can probably imagine, but actually attaining the age of 70 in the 1730s is quite an achievement, much less achievement at the bottom of a coal mine. What basically happened was the little lad had enough for sense to actually climb up to a slanting, which was where a previous seam that had been dug out, and there was like a little shelf up there, because don't forget, when this water came through, all their lights were extinguished, they were in pitch black, they couldn't see, and also it was very dangerous gases down there. So basically, the little boy, he climbed up onto this shelf, let out some light, loud moans, and his three comrades came and joined him, and they were down there, all told, for 10 days and nights. In the first day, they managed to find a little bit of food that somebody had dropped on when they escaped, but after that, they had nothing to eat, and actually had to survive on even a wicker basket they found, and some shoes, not necessarily conducive to diet. After, as I said, their colleagues kept on and kept on and kept on, they wouldn't leave them down there, and even underneath great danger themselves, they continued to search for their lost colleagues, not even 100% sure they were still alive. What they eventually did, due to black damp, which is basically a sort of gas that was caused by the deluge underground, they couldn't even go down with lighted torches. So what they did eventually to draw the black damp out was they let down a flaming brazier, and apparently that drew the damp out, which gave them enough time to get down there and search their colleagues, and eventually, as I said, after 10 days and 10 nights, and I think it was something like 7 hours, they found them and got them up, and to be perfectly frank, a massive knees up and sued afterwards. And £25, which is an extraordinary amount for poor people to raise in that day and age, because all four of them had gone blind, and had actually started to hallucinate. They weren't a lot of good to work. The local was 70, died a couple of years later, but a 10-year-old lived on. And in fact, several of the rescuers actually pop up in some of the later riots I'm going to talk about. The first riot I'm going to talk about was mentioned in the Elihu manuscripts, which is held by the local library, Bristol Library. Elihu was a learned, if you like, vicar who actually was down in Kingsford Forest in the late 18th century, who collated a lot of documents left behind by predecessors. And one of these documents was a list of squatters of 1660, the rights actually took off, sorry. And basically, they took off after Charles II retained the crown and came back. He had this bright idea that he was going to re-exert his authority over the forest and sent a couple of his trusted colleagues down to go and exert this authority. They turned up, obviously, finding, well, for all intents and purposes, a lawless society which were governed by their own rules and regulations and its own family linkages. And they tried to exert their authority. The sheriff's men came on, tried to knock down squatters' homes. All the squatters got together en masse and drove them off. Over 2 days there was a mass fighting there, and they eventually reclaimed the land and put down their marker. There wasn't any further attempts for some considerable time to exert the Crown's authority. In 1725, there's three different types, I'm going to talk about three different types of right this evening. There was quite a few rights in the Kingswood area, as I'm sure you're probably aware. But like the rights I'm going to talk about, I'm going to talk about some tollpike rights, when that's actually a tollpike, for those of you who don't know, or turnpikes, or a toll gate, is when, in the old days, when the local authorities didn't have the bylaws or planning rights to update roads. Basically, sometimes, what would happen was the local magistrates, dignitaries and such like, would raise a local act, pass it through government, and then they were allowed to actually charge people for using a particular road. And the money they were supposedly raised by these charges were then used to update the roads and keep it in a safe condition. In 1727, they attempted this on the road from Kingston to Bristol. They'd given fair warnings to people, and to be perfectly honest, the Kingswood colliers were underneath the impression, some owners of them were impression, that coal was going to be exempt. But unfortunately, when the prices were cut up, coal was not exempt. They wrote to the mayor complaining, nothing was done about it. So when the toll gates were erected, they went down once again en masse, a large body, and ripped them down. This happened over a couple of days, and basically, the roads into Bristol and also the roads up to Bath were untolled, completely free. And the Kingswood colleagues actually wrote to the trustees of the toll gates, pointing out that they had ample time, the ample quality of produce lying about to fix the roads. They didn't actually have to charge the people for using the roads. And the magistrates ignored this, the dignitaries ignored this, and they threw up some more toll gates. These once again were ripped down, a nice bonfire was made, and to be perfectly frank, what happened then was the colliers then started charging their own tolls. I suppose basically, the way they thought about it, they worked down the hole digging out coal, so basically they decided in a good trade union style to have their own hardship funds. And some people, they were charging quite a significant amount, half a crown of some large landowners in the trying to use the roads. What actually happened in the end, the tolls went up, they were ripped down, went up, ripped down again, and the local authorities gave up. They didn't give up completely. What they did do was they applied and were awarded an act by central government, making it a crime, chargeable with 7 years transportation. In those days that would be to America, because it was pre-American Revolution. So 7 years transportation for the destruction of a toll gate. And they tried to erect some more up at Tokyo. I don't know where Tokyo is, it's in between Bath and Bristol. And some more colliers appeared, this time in women's clothes, which is quite funny. I mean, I don't know if any of you know about the Luddites and the Rebecca Rites, they also wore women's clothes, and some other rites, now and again men did wear women's clothes. So some people feel this is perhaps a disguise, but also the local militia sometimes wouldn't wish to fire on women. And so it might be for that reason as well. Anyway, they called, in 1731, there was a new turnpike act, which then coal was exempt on all the roads leading into Bristol. And this seems to be a direct effect of the Kingswood colleagues and their attempts to make sure that they were not were put out of business, basically, by these excessive tolls on their bringing their produce. Now, something else I'd like to point out as well was Bristol was near enough reliant on Kingswood coal. When this first kicked off, the Bristol mayor actually started applying to the South Wales to try to get coal in, because they realised that if Kingswood colliers stopped bringing their coal in, then some of the major businesses in Bristol would actually falter. And when you think of some of the businesses, the main industries in Bristol, the brassworks, the soap, the sugar, the glassworks, most of these did use excessive amounts of coal that came from Kingswood. So therefore, for all intents and purposes, the Kingswood colliers had the Bristol industrialists by the short and curtains. In 1738, there's another very important riot, and this is a wage riot. It's another type of riot. It's an early sort of collective bargaining by mob, if you like. one large coal works actually started to reduce the wages. But what they were doing, they tried to undercut some of the other coal big colliers and undercut pull the coal out cheaper. And they tried to, basically what they did is there was a knock-on domino effect, so all the other big colliers, to keep up with this one collier, if they all started to reduce the wages of the miners. And obviously, as I said, a lot of them were on very, very short margins, and they just couldn't handle this. Their families would literally starve. They weren't prepared to put their life at risk down underneath of feet and feet and feet of land, digging out coal for Bristol's industry without actually receiving any benefit for it. So first off, once again, they did try to riot. And they wrote to local owners pointing out that they were being forced to action by the colliers, the owners' actions. And therefore, giving them prior warning. The colliers didn't act, the owners didn't act, and sure enough, what happened was a major conflagration. Local miners seized some pits, broke up the machinery on top, threw it down, such like. But then, once again, they came into Bristol. But first off, before they went into Bristol, what they actually did was, once again, they stopped all the roads in Bristol and manned the entrances in and started putting a toll once again, like a hardship fund. It was very, very organised. They made a statement to the mayor saying they would rather riot than starve, and all they wanted was bread. This wasn't exactly true, because after making that claim, about six of them peeled off and made off to Tottenham, where they made some lamb in there, drove large amounts of alcohol, knocked down the pub's parrot for some obscure reason, obviously giving a bit of jits or something, and threatened to bob the landlady's head as well. They then went up to Brislington, which was called Bustleton at the time, and I mean, different reports have it. Some say they pressed some good, God-fearing miners into action, but others say a lot of the miners did actually join them, because I felt they understood as well that if the wages went down in Kingswood, then Brislington would be next, closely followed by Corbyn. So basically, once again, they started marching into Bristol, stopping off at the odd drinking establishment on the way, threatening the locality, drinking and eating whatever they could, and moving on. By the time they got to Bristol, there was quite a few of them now, a couple of hundred at least, and they were quite merry, to say the least. And they literally marched through the centre of Bristol, while the magistrate and the local militia just stood back and let them get on with it. There was nothing the local authorities could do about it. They were just too strong. They were finding coal carts, tipping them over, cutting coal sacks, and stuff like that. Basically, they then threatened fire engines, which was very important, obviously, and also the locks outside the city. They were literally holding the city to ransom. They went back to some of the pits and started to extort the protection money out of them. And after a long, protracted period of rioting, and a lot of destruction to pits, most of the pit owners gave in and brought the wages back up. Most of the rioters went back to work. There were some arrests. One Edward Stone was actually arrested. He wasn't hung, funny enough, for just some pub talk. A couple of his friends grasped him up for basically telling that which pit owners should have their colliers top gear slashed or cut and broken. And that was basically what he was hung for. Mind you, at the same time, roughly, there was an outbreak of Methodism. I suppose you've always heard of John Wesley and Whitfield and his life. I've got a quote here, which I find wildly amusing, from George Whitfield in 1739. He said, "My bowels have long since yearned towards the poor colliers, who are very numerous as a sheep without a shepherd. I bet the colliers are looking forward to it." I don't know if he was going to actually try to convert them or crap on them. But whatever the case was, the Methodists made their way in John Wesley and Charles Wesley. They built schools down there. The local kids who went to the schools were up at 4 o'clock in the morning to start their studies, because Wesley was a firm believer that any child who played would also play as a man. So therefore, discipline was needed to extol them at a very early day. And they were talking of some of the crowds they were speaking to at Rose Green and the West Indian Cricket Club is now hanging them out of crowds between sometimes 10 to 20,000. It does make you wonder who was down the pits digging out the coal at the time, and also how many people could actually hear what he was saying. Because as you can see here today, I've got a mic to 20,000 people on a windy day on Hannah Mount. I doubt they could all hear it. Brings to mind Monty Python, the Blessing of the Cheesemakers. But anyway, there was a lot of success for the Methodists, no doubt about it. A lot of colliers did actually start to see the word, if you like, and did start going to church. There was, I suppose you've heard about the famous John Wesley quote, when he was preaching to a lot of colliers about the white gutters of their tears rolling down their cold, laden faces, as they were told that Jesus loved them. And 1740, I think is quite indicative of some of the change for some of the colliers in the area, was when there was a wheat price increase shortly after the arrival of the Methodists. A crowd of about 1,000 were going to go down to see the mayor once again and ask for some sort of action on helping them out. And basically Wesley met this crowd of 1,000 and talked them out of actually entering Bristol and having a riot. They sent in a deputation of mainly elderly people, some women and some children, to try to send to them there, who promised them that justice would be done, but didn't actually do a great deal. About 2 months later, the price did decrease, but I'm unsure of the actual effort the body has had. Excuse me. But, as I said, the Methodists did have a large effect. A couple of churches were built up there, a few schools, and also there were some really, really funny stories from the time about exorcisms going on in the area. That there were people that were possessed with devils and such like, when John Wesley would come into the room and do all these convulsions and shankings. And in Lyme Bar, there's some very good reading in there. And to be perfectly frank, it does sound like some people were actually pulling Wesley's leg from a very, very great height. But anyway, the last night I'm going to talk about is the 1753 one, which, getting back to the wheat one, or the one that was avoided in 1740 when Wesley talks about very similar circumstances. The price of wheat had gone up to such an extent that the local kings of colliers couldn't afford it anymore. And don't forget, bread for these miners was a large part of their staple diet. Some studies of the period reckon it could have made up to 70% of their weekly food allowances on bread. So therefore, if the price of wheat goes up, it's going to have quite a drastic effect on the families. Once again, they marched into town, a large amount of them, and once again, they went to see the mayor, who once again promised them that something would be done. Some of them must have had long memories, so they didn't believe it. And off they toppled, and they found out about a ship that was laden with wheat that was off to Ireland that afternoon. It was actually exporting wheat. There was whole ships in Bristol. It was actually going to export wheat for profit, while people in Bristol starved. First off, they talked to the captain and tried to convince him to unload the ship, which he wouldn't do, so they gave him a hand and they entered the ship themselves and unloaded it. Basically, and then put it on the side, and I'm not too sure what happened there, but in some other riots of a similar nature, what would happen is people would set a fair price. E.P. Thompson talks about the moral economy of the crowd in his book Customs and Comedy, which is a very interesting book which I'd encourage you to read if you get a chance. And basically, what would happen? But they'd sit there and literally flog the bread or the wheat, whatever the case may be, for a price that was set by the crowd, that was affordable, and was, to be perfectly honest, a regular market price prior to any increase. I'm not 100% sure if this went on. It sounds as if they didn't actually get the chance, because when the price of wheat went up, it seems as if the magistrates and also the mayor thought that trouble might occur. So they actually sworn in some extra special constables who were well tooled up. There was also some sailors, I suppose, from the boat that had been unloaded and cut the city, who actually attacked the colliers in a large fight in the street. A couple of colliers were hurt and a couple were taken. The colliers reminded the magistrate that they were coming through their friends the next day, and sure enough they came into town the next day with the threat of pulling down the prison and freeing some of their colleagues. The colliers were unarmed. Some of the women had stones in their aprons, but this was the only arms they had. And they came in through the bridewell bridge, over the bridewell by there, and the local magistrates and the militia were waiting for them. loaded with ball and musket. They shot into the crowd. Three people were killed, and many more were injured, and 29 were taken. There was basically a chase ensued, and the unarmed colliers were chased back outside and without Northwood's gate by this large posse of local Bristolians. And to be perfectly frank, those sounds were completely fed up with the Kingsford colliers coming in and setting the stakes from time to time. However, the colliers, as I said, were often called barbarians and such like, but their actions didn't always hold us out. There was one youth, apparently, who chased a couple of colliers and actually fired two shots at them, missed them both times. The colliers came back, disarmed him, and just put him down the pit for a couple of days to chill out. You know, they could have well easily killed him. He'd actually tried to kill them, and they made no attempts to do this. Bristol, the city of, felt a bit guilty about what they'd done to the colliers, and actually the mayor collected together some money to help with some of the hardships that were being felt, and also they sent a surgeon out to deal with some of the 50 plus injuries caused by being shot at by the Bristolians. Unfortunately, the people who were caught, some of them were pardoned, but some of them were given 2 years sentences, which was quite a lot in that day. The next step up would be the step of transportation. But they were also charged, they were also fined, should I say, up to £4 something to keep the peace. And they weren't let out of prison until they paid that. In fact, some of them, it was a lot more than £4, I do apologise, some of them it was up to £200. Some of them knowing it was so-called ringleaders. Obviously, these colliers could never ever afford this, and it seems that some of them actually rotted in jail. But don't forget either that prisons in those basements weren't nice places by any stretch of the imagination. Quite a few people never actually got to trial. They actually died of typhus or other attendant diseases whilst in prison. So, you know, to be perfectly honest, what actually happened to those colliers is they ended up being put behind bars with no chance of getting out, and serving as a very, very strong message to the others not to do it again. Before I hand over to the next one, I'm just going to tell you about some other funny events that happened with the Kingsmen colliers. They certainly had their own sense of humour. In the 1780s, a couple of people were sent up to collect the tithes of the colliers, which they obviously didn't read their job description of the previous incumbents. So they went up there thinking they were going to have a happy day collecting tithes. What the Kingsmen colliers actually did was bundled them and got them, put them down a local pit, until they promised or signed a document saying that they would not rob and pork from Kingsmen colliers ever again. They did have a heart of colliers. They brought them up every couple of hours, gave them a little bit of gingerbread and also some gin more on the counter. Where they got the gin from, I don't know. And then put them down again, so they swear to sign this document. Eventually, the tithe collector saw the error of their ways and signed a document promising that it would not bother the colliers. And the colliers charged them 8 shillings and 6 pence for their breakfast, which was quite reasonable at the time. Also, there's another thing, Stevious side, if you like, perhaps to the Kingsmen colliers. They were also available for hire. There were several election riots in 1735, 1810, 1814, 1820s, where they were apparently hired out by the Tories as well. Because don't forget, at this time I'm talking about the Whigs for the ruling establishment. They were hired out by the Tories for a bloody good election fraud. So that basically what they would do is they'd hang about outside polling areas and try to put people off voting. But also in 1732, the one Richard Rouse was found guilty of a lewd and horrible offence and was due to be put in the stocks. Stocks, usually people put in the stocks on Saturday afternoon on market day for all people to see. It wasn't normally a happy experience for people in the stocks. Sometimes, if it was a popular figure, then a collection would occur and nothing would happen to them, and they were released unharmed. Sometimes big takers, people like that, or unpopular people, were put in the stocks, were given a very hard time, and sometimes lost eyes and such likes, or were close to death with the crowd's attention while they were in the stocks. This one Richard Grant obviously feared the worst, and he got himself a steel skull cap, some brown paper for his clothes, and also employed 100 colliers to defend him from the attentions of the crowd. He was put in a stocks for a short period of time, and a massive brawl ensued. And basically, the local constabulary felt it'd be a good idea. It wasn't constabulary, it's a local magistrate. Thought it'd be a good idea to take him out of the stocks and perhaps not fulfil that part of his sentence due to public disorder within the centre of Bristol. On the whole, the Kingswood colleagues, I think, are a very interesting group of people. The whole thing about, you know, the freedom, the free miners and the squats and such like are rare in British society at the time. I mean, the Forest of Dean miners, you might have heard of them, Warren James in the 1820s, and there was an uprising. They had similar freedoms as well. The freedom to squat and such like, the freedom to mine. And also this sort of came out of their actual persona, the way they viewed them, and viewed their world. And such like, they were more than willing to fight tooth and nail in defence of their rights. Unfortunately, things started to go a bit pear-shaped for them in the 1810s and 1820s, when large tracts of Kingswood Forest were eventually enclosed, and even closure acts. Amongst things being closed, and you had a landowner who could actually put out their authority over Kingswood Forest, it became a lot harder. And also the local magistrates started to round up more troublesome locals, if you like. And I could start about the Cock Road Gap, but that's another story. Okay, thank you very much indeed for your attention tonight.